You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this episode is presented by Rosalind English.
You may remember, LawPod listeners, that we visited the subject of a British Bill of Rights before in this series. That is, a human rights regime that might follow from our departure from the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, should that departure take place. Well, I have with me today Lord Sumption, formerly of the Supreme Court. His latest book, The Challenges of Democracy, collects together his thoughts on individual rights and how best they can be protected in law. Lord Sumption, you say in your chapter, The Legitimacy of Law, that the European Convention hands over two critically important powers to the European Court of Human Rights. These, you say, are intensely political powers. What are these powers?
It hands over the right, which effectively the Strasbourg Court has helped itself to, since the 1970s, to develop the text of the Convention, to recognise the existence of rights which are not to be found in the Convention, but which are thought to be, in a loose sense, in the spirit of the Convention, the sort of things that those who drafted the Convention might possibly have included in it if they were alive today. I think that's probably a fair description, although it's not one I think that actually has any basis in the language of any of the judgments of the Strasbourg Court. But it's what's happening.
Is this what the court itself called back in 1978,
Tyra.
1978, thank you. The living instrument doctrine of interpreting the Convention.
That's right, yes.
And what has that meant in terms of the individual articles, the individual rights as they're enshrined in the Convention?
Well, what it has meant is that the court has effectively emancipated itself from the text of the Convention, which is the only thing that the states party to the Convention ever agreed. It's certainly not an approach to interpretation, which is normal in international law. The principles on which treaties are interpreted are set out in the Vienna Convention on the Interpretation of Treaties, and they are basically very similar to those which apply to the interpretation of UK statutes. You take the natural meaning of the words in their context, but it's not what the Strasbourg Court does. The living instrument doctrine authorises the Strasbourg Court, according to its own view, to branch out by what I would call a process of extrapolation of the text of the Convention so as to devise new rights that are not actually recognised in the text.
You do devote a whole chapter in your book on the mission creep of Article 6, which started, as I understand it, as an articulated right of access to court, but it has become something much more than that, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Article 8 is undoubtedly the main engine of mission creep, but Article 6 is quite an important one also. That, as you point out, confers a right of access to a court, and that has been developed by the Strasbourg Court into a series of rules about what the outcome should be when you get to a court. Obviously, the simplest case is where you've got some rule of law in a convention country which precludes you from applying to the court. And that can only be justified if there is no really overwhelming countervailing interest. The access to the court is one of the most important rights in any society, and certainly one of the most important rights conferred by the Convention. The problem is, what happens if, when you get to a court, there is a rule of law which says you're going to lose? Now, you've had access to a court, but there have been many cases in which the Strasbourg Court has said, well, you haven't really had access to the court because you didn't win. And that seems to me to bring the Article 6 into a completely different area of jurisprudence, basically the area of what rights we ought to have in addition to being able to access courts. Whether, for example, we should be allowed to sue the police. The common law rule in the United Kingdom was that there are public interest considerations which make it highly undesirable that people should be allowed to sue the police for negligence. The Strasbourg court has taken a different view, but the law of tort in most countries decides what rights one should have, and it seems to me to be absurd to say that you have been denied a court if, when you get to the court applies a rule of domestic law, which means that you aren't going to win.
So you have quite strong words for a recent ruling by the Strasbourg court in a climate change case for Ein Klima Seniorinnen Schweiz versus Switzerland. And that was Article 8 and Article 6. And you say few decisions have so openly demonstrated the Strasbourg court's contempt for democracy or claimed for its judges a roving brief covering the whole field of national public policy. By any reasonable intellectual standard, the right to respect for private and family life, the home and correspondence, does not imply any rule governing climate change policy. Now, we know that the English judge, the dissenting judge on that case, Tim Eicher, has given a lecture on that judgment. I'd like to know a little bit more about what you think of the judgment and what it says about the court.
It is the most recent example of a number of problems about the mission creep of the court. There are basically two major problems about the living instrument doctrine, both of which are exemplified by the climate change decision. One is that it is not consistent with the rule of law. The basic principle underlying the rule of law is that law must be accessible. It must not be retrospective. You have got to be able to know in advance what your legal rights and liabilities are, and that applies to the state as much as it does to private individuals. Now, if you continually reinvent the scope of Article 8 by constantly expanding it, what you are actually doing is inventing principles of law which are not in the convention, but which you think ought to apply, and you are then applying it retrospectively. So it is not possible to say in advance of a decision whether the convention is going to be applied to climate change or to general questions of public health or not. And the open-ended nature of this principle is remarkable, because the reasoning essentially involved saying that there is a right to good health or to the state's support of good health, and that was the right that was interfered with by Switzerland failing to take what was regarded as appropriate action to contribute to dealing with climate change. Now, I think that the problem here is that Switzerland in 2020, which was the date at which it was said to have infringed the convention, had no means of knowing that this decision was going to be made, and therefore the most fundamental foundation of the rule of law was not satisfied in that case. The other problem is the more general one that I've mentioned, which is that this is a fundamentally anti-democratic process for deciding what the law is. There is a remarkable paragraph in the judgment on the Swiss climate change case, paragraph 412, in which they refer to the fact that the reason why Switzerland had a hiatus during which there was no relevant rule about the amount of atmospheric carbon that they were prepared to tolerate was that a statute which was passed by the Swiss Parliament was subsequently vetoed as a result of the referendum. In Swiss law, any parliamentary statute can, if a minimum of signatures is obtained from voters in a petition, be submitted to a referendum. And this one was submitted to a referendum and was rejected by the Swiss electorate. Now, that meant that they had to start again and devise a new statute. And they did that. 4-year gap, the new statute was accepted. Now, the criticism that the Strasbourg court had of Switzerland in that case effectively, therefore, was that it was quite wrong for the electorate of Switzerland to have rejected a statute dealing with climate change, of which the Strasbourg court approved because they regarded it as more consistent with the views of the International Panel on Climate Change at the United Nations. Now, referring to this in paragraph 412, they say, well, democracy is not just a matter of deciding what the majority want. It depends on the rule of law. Well, now, conceptually, the rule of law is something quite different from democracy. They may both be desirable, but they're not the same thing. And what they meant by the rule of law was the law which they had just invented. And I find it very difficult to accept that the rule of law is really what is engaged in that kind of exercise. So what you have is the overruling, purported overruling, of a democratic decision by the entire electorate of Switzerland in order to satisfy the demands of the International Panel on Climate Change. Now, whatever else you may say about this, and of course climate change activists are absolutely delighted by it, whatever else you might say about it, it clearly is not consistent with a democracy. And it also raises another more general issue, which is that most people who defend the convention tend to say, well, it's produced some wonderful decisions that we wouldn't otherwise have. It's given us this, that, and the other right. This is actually a little like saying that Mussolini was fine because he made the trains run on time. The fundamental question about the convention is whether this is a sensible and democratic way of deciding what the law should be in a democracy. And it manifestly isn't. It confers what is essentially a legislative power on a body standing outside the constitutional framework of the nations which have ultimate legislative power over their own law. It is therefore, in the most literal sense of the word, a wholly irresponsible body. I don't mean that in the normal colloquial sense. It's irresponsible in the sense that it is not responsible to anyone. Parliament in the UK and equivalent legislators in other countries, Parliament has a revocable mandate to legislate. It's elected and responsible to the electorate. If the electorate doesn't like it or what it's done, it can boot out the MPs of a particular party at the next general election. None of that, of course, applies to the Strasbourg Court. The Strasbourg Court creates law which is incapable of being amended or revoked, short of actually leaving the convention system, or else short of the Strasbourg Court changing its mind, which it very rarely does.
Along the same lines, you say that the legal status of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is controversial. It's not a treaty, but a statement of common aspirations by the nations of the world. And that, of course, is what the European Convention on Human Rights and Freedoms is based on.
But it's very different in the sense that that does purport to be more than a series of aspirations. It purports to be a statement of the law which every signatory state is required to adopt as part of its domestic law.
Does this mean, Lord Sumption, have we reached an era where international institutions as a whole are coming under some critical scrutiny? I'm thinking, for example, of the recent sanctions against personnel at the International Criminal Court following the sanctions brought against Benjamin Netanyahu after South Africa's application to that court. Is this showing us the direction of travel?
I think that it is. I mean, I have no objection at all to the International Criminal Court, because the International Criminal Court is essentially concerned not with the domestic internal laws and policies of signatory states, but with, in the broadest possible sense, international relations. It exists in order to prevent tyrants, and it is mostly tyrants, though it could be democracies, I suppose, from behaving towards other people in a way that is regarded as criminal, for example, because it's genocidal or because it's aggressive warfare and so on. Now, I have no problem about the notion that international law should govern the relationship between states or between international entities in that way. I mean, the case of Israel is a bit more complicated than that, because the question whether Palestine, the two branches of Palestine, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, are capable of being party to it is a controversial question, but it's one that the court has decided is. in its favour. So the position is that for the purposes of criminal liability and international liability, the Gaza Strip and the West Bank are regarded as if they were states, although technically they probably aren't. Now, that is one area where I think international law has a perfectly legitimate part to play. And the reason why nations enter into obligations of that kind is, and it's worth pointing out that neither Israel nor the United States has signed up to the Rome Convention. The reason why states do that is that there are treaties which govern the relationship between international entities, which is in their interest. International peace and the avoidance of international crimes is in the interest, one would have thought, of all nations, even Israel and the United States. But let's not argue about that. That's very different from a treaty like the Convention, which is entirely concerned with the domestic law of signatory states. There is absolutely nothing in the Human Rights Convention which the signatory states like the United Kingdom cannot do domestically if they want to. That makes it a very different kind of treaty to the Rome Treaty governing the International Criminal Court, which is concerned with laying down principles that can't be achieved by nations without international cooperation. The legitimate area of international law is international relations or international problems. Let me make another example, which we've been discussing for another purpose, climate change. Now, climate change is a problem which I think by general consent can really only be dealt with at an international level. It's quite useless for just a few states to do it. It is clearly beneficial to humanity, including that part of it that lives in the United Kingdom, that we should do what we can to address the problem of climate change. It's therefore perfectly legitimate to have international treaties like the Paris Convention, which require a measure of cooperation so as to deal with a problem capable of being dealt with in no other way. But there's no problem raised by the Human Rights Convention which is incapable of being dealt with domestically. We can have whatever rights we want. The object of the Human Rights Convention is to ensure that we have some rights which we may not want. And that seems to me to be inconsistent with some basic democratic principles.
In your view, if we were to withdraw from the Council of Europe and therefore the European Convention of Human Rights and the Strasbourg Court and so on, we'd put in place our own Bill of Rights, as it were. Some might argue that that would become a victim of human rights-minded lawyers and judges and be interpreted in exactly the same democracy-undermining way as the Strasbourg Court interprets the Convention.
Well, I think that it would be necessary, if we enacted the same provisions as are in the Convention, to have provisions governing how it was to be interpreted. And those provisions would essentially, I'm not drafting now, but suggesting the general lines, would essentially require the court to interpret it in the same way as an English domestic statute and without reference to the jurisprudence built up in relation to similar wording by the Strasbourg Court. There would be a problem of transition. What does one do about those principles enunciated by Strasbourg, which have already been incorporated into English law by decisions of the courts? And I think that probably the right way of dealing with that would be to provide that they could be revoked by a court at the same level as the one which had originally adopted it. I mean, obviously, the detailed drafting requires a great deal of thought, but the concept is perfectly straightforward and not really a problem.
Just thinking of the current run-in, shall we say, between Baroness Carr and the leader of the opposition, the Prime Minister, do you believe that judges should be completely above criticism?
No, of course I don't. And I have occasionally criticised them myself, both judicially and extrajudicially. I mean, I think that judges, like everybody else in public life, have got to get used to the idea that they have to decide controversial questions on which people will disagree. There are many decisions which, before they ever go to the Court of Appeal or the Supreme Court, many people will feel are wrong in law. Now, I do not know on what basis the Prime Minister said that that particular decision was wrong, But he did say that it was wrong, and I would assume that he had either thought about it himself, he's a very distinguished lawyer himself, or else he had received advice to that effect from government lawyers. Now, in either case, it seems to me perfectly legitimate for him to say, I think that this is wrong, and indeed, if the Prime Minister were to direct an appeal from the relevant decision, he would implicitly be saying he thinks it's wrong, even if he didn't say it in terms. I certainly think that politicians ought not to abuse or threaten judges, but that is not what either the Leader of the Opposition or the Prime Minister were doing in the House of Commons, and I think it was really over the top for the Chief Justice to suggest that they were doing something wrong by expressing their view on that. I find it very hard to know what the Prime Minister is supposed to do if, in the House of Commons, he is asked by the Leader of the Opposition, do you accept that this is wrong, or do you think it's wrong, and what are you going to do about it? How do you answer that question? Do you say, I'm awfully sorry, I can't tell you what I think about it, because the Chief Justice might get cross with me? I mean, I really think this was a decision which I suspect our very admirable Chief Justice might one day regret that she had made.
And on that note, we don't know whether the government may appeal, probably not, the Ghazan immigration case, but even if they do, this particular spat will be remembered as a clash between Parliament and judges.
I mean, I spent a lot of my career at the bar advising governments and appearing for them in court. And I know perfectly well that when you lose a case, there may be more sensible ways of dealing with the issue than appealing. You may amend the relevant statutory provision, which is perfectly straightforward if it's a secondary legislation, not so straightforward if it's primary legislation. You basically have to assess your options, and therefore the government may decide not to appeal. But it sounds from what the Prime Minister said as if one way or another they're going to ensure that the law is changed.
Although without withdrawing from the convention and the court, we still have to live with Article 8.
Yes.
Which is the provision under which the upper tribunal made its decision.
Yes, it is. And whether they correctly interpreted Article 8 is a matter on which all of us are entitled to an opinion. The only difference that it makes being a court of appeal is that your opinion subject to the Supreme Court is decisive, whereas the opinion of the Prime Minister may or may not be right. I will only just add one thing, which is that the only argument that anybody has ever really put forward for defending our decision to bind ourselves to the Human Rights Convention is that it's good for countries more benighted than ourselves, which need our example in order to get their law right. I think that this is a piece of pretentious twaddle. Frankly, nobody's decision about whether to adopt the Human Rights Convention is going to be influenced by what the United Kingdom does. If you are just emerging from 60 years of communist dictatorship, you may take a completely different view as to what sort of laws you want in your domestic forum to the one that we in Britain take after several centuries of constitutional government. And the specious comparison of our position if we withdrew to that of Belarus and Russia is positively dishonest, because Belarus and Russia are countries with no independent courts. In Russia, there is reliable evidence that the minister can ring up the judge and tell him what to do. Nothing like that happens in the UK. We have a judiciary of very high quality, which is wholly independent. So I think we can forget that comparison for a start.
And that is one of the main arguments against leaving the court, that we somehow set an example, but that is overemphasising our importance in the eyes of the world.
I believe that to be so.
Thank you very much, Lord Sumption. That was most interesting discussion. Let's see what happens.
Yes.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Rosalind English. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row.